You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
The Vietnam War, it's over.
Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
Welcome to Belt Loaded, the officially unofficial podcast for The Expanse on sci-fi. I'm Jim.
For now, I'm Aaron.
We are talking about Season 3, Episode 7, titled Delta V. Do you want to start talking about what we thought about the episode, or should we address my intro?
No, let's talk about the episode like we always do, and then we'll talk about like the latest news on The Expanse.
What'd you think?
I was really actively hostile to this episode for about the first 20 minutes because like, you're going to fucking yada yada through the discovery of the ring, the breakup of the crew of the Rocinante, Ava Sarala's climb through the top. Like, I don't like any of this shit. This is fast forwarding through a bunch of stuff that I want to see. And then halfway through the episode, I'm like, okay, fine. Guess because they started filling. They started backing up and kind of giving us enough information, and I guess the stuff that the yada yadding through is probably boring. It does kind of, like, stretch my kind of credibility that it would take, what, 180-some days to get some kind of first mission through the ring? Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess I thought with the Epstein drive they could get to Uranus faster than that. Is this a political problem and not a... Like, seriously, no one's tried to fly through this ring before... The gravity slingshot guy?
They have. I don't want to say too much. Okay, so this is the dividing line between Book 2 and Book 3.
Okay.
Like, the yada this, yada here is the stuff that they leave out because they've gone to another book.
Because so the book ends with the squid leaving
Venus. I can't remember if there's actually a squid, but it ends with the formation of the ring.
Okay.
And then Book 3 picks up... later on, like we do in the show.
Do they catch you up in what happened, or is that just kind of... Because I've heard people discuss the Expanse books, and it does seem like in between each book is some sort of indeterminate amount of time, well, probably determinate amount of time, where Rossi has been hunting pirates in the asteroid belt, or, like, you know, doing
just
some...
taking commissions.
Right, yeah. Right, and they just skipped abruptly to the next thing that happens.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's kind of why it feels weird, is because there's a gap there for the books, but, like...
And I think that's the first time it's happened on this show, right? That we've had, like, a huge time skip forward?
This big, 187 days is a while.
Right, and so much happened, like, to people I care about.
And that's the thing, like, I wish they had given some sort of closure to the Prax thing with the crew.
That's what I'm
saying. Because Prax is just fucking gone now,
Prax
apparently.
Is gone, Bobby's gone, Bobby
still has some communication, but we don't see anything of Prax this episode.
We hear about him, but...
He got his daughter, and then he just peaced out, said, thanks for the help, guys, I'm gone.
I mean, it does seem like there's more to it than that, and maybe we'll find out. Maybe Prax will come back. I don't know, but I was like, yeah, that's my core complaint. I was not that the episode is bad, just like I felt very lost and emotionally raw that all these people have been scattered hither and yon throughout the solar system, and I'm just getting breadcrumbs about them.
No, it is a weird thing to do in the middle of a season, and that's just a symptom of them doing, like, cutting season 2 into the first half of book 2.
Yeah.
And so now they're hitting, you know, the gap in the middle of the season.
I kind of feel like if it had been opening of the season, I still would have been just as outraged because, like, you know, half of the Rocinante crew thus far have been detached from the ship. And also they started with the slingshot pilot, which I'm like, I don't know about some of these outsized belter personalities. Let's put it that way.
You didn't like his green braided mohawk.
It took me a while to warm up to Miller and his crazy hair and fedoras bullshit. You know, I'm kind of joking, but he does seem like a bit of a tool.
Oh, sure. I mean, he's meant to be like a punk, you know?
And then
he gets
turned into fucking chunky salsa at the end. Jesus, and pretty glorious.
Yeah,
and that's that, like, when I first saw that, I was just like, Jesus Christ. I mean, I expected something to happen, but not that. So, yeah, I guess it's an episode of The Expanse that really caught me off balance. By the end of the episode, I was digging it because, hey, we got Miller back. Speaking of,
my favorite character is back.
Weird haired douchebags.
I was wondering if they were going to do that. I'm glad they did.
And the second time I watched it, I really enjoyed it because there's a lot of really cool things here. Like, you know, the belters trying to stand up and like the culture rifts between that and, you know, I was kind of worried that it seemed like that the solar system just quickly, like Aaron Wright's arrested as a traitor, Secretary General got shit canned, Mars and Earth are working together with the belt, everything's kumbaya, there's not going to be any more political intrigue, it's going to be, you know, fucking the solar system versus the interloper, and nope, that's certainly not going to happen. So feels like the same old Expanse. Got a lot of Amos backstory. What did you think as a person that knew this was all coming? I guess
I liked it. It honestly regrounded me in the stuff that I know from the books, which is good in my mind. It's hard to say, like, was this just a good episode of The Expanse on its own, like the last few were, because I know what they're doing here. But, I thought I was entertained the whole time. And I was certainly, like, looking at things and going, okay, yeah, I know where they're going. This will be fun. So I don't know. I really enjoyed it.
Okay. So let's talk about Expanse news. What a week! What a week! The Save the Expanse signature campaign crested over 140,000 yesterday. I haven't even checked it today. It probably clocked over that. Tons of celebrities have signed on to the petition, including, you know, obviously Adam Savage, Will Wheaton, to name just a few. George Martin. George Martin took to his you know, to do some other non Game of Thrones writing on his blog to stump for The Expanse.
He should volunteer to write for this show.
I didn't know this, but I guess one of the authors, I'm not sure which one, it's Ty and who?
Daniel.
One of them, I guess, was an assistant to George Martin. I did not know that. So that's kind of cool. There's a neat pedigree there.
Yeah.
I hope they're a little bit more stick-to-itive or less writing themselves into
the
corner.
They're cranking books out.
Okay, cool.
There's no worry there.
Plus, I imagine that, like, having another author makes it easier because you can, like, there's another brain helping you through conflicts and untying knots and stuff like that.
And just the motivation, too. Like,
yeah.
When you're like, I sold the TV show and I've got a successful series and other stories to tell. Yeah, a guy can jump in.
Jesus
and say,
Christ,
no, we've
got a digression inside of the digression here. Someone raised $4,000 as a stunt to launch the model of the Rocinante that we were talking about last week in space. Did you see that? Yeah, apparently for $4,000 you can put any particular payload in orbit and
get out of here.
They're going to do that. Yeah.
It's just some guy with a trebuchet in his yard.
It
says this thing's going all the way to space.
Right. I don't think it's going to be in it's certainly not going to be in geosynchronous orbit. It's going to be like a low Earth orbit that eventually decays and burns up, but it's kind of cool.
Yeah.
It's kind of cool. And, you know, maybe it'll be still orbiting when these Rocinantes are worth $30,000 and somebody will go up there and, you know, and get it. And then yesterday, in the most exciting news, someone had posted that Amazon had agreed to pick up the series for season four, and everybody was like hallelujahing, and then there was like an hour later a bucket of cold water thrown on it by saying the talks are still ongoing. But
well, yeah, it was the title of the fucking headline of this article was "The Expanse is saved," right. 500 exclamation marks.
Right.
And then in the text of the article, they say they're in talks to pick it up.
Right.
I'm like, fuck you guys.
So I just don't know how excited to get about that. Because again, mm-hmm. like I said last week, I think its best hope is for sci-fi to just renew it. Because like there is nothing that needs to be done. They just need to say, yeah, let's keep doing it. You know, on the other hand, am I excited for the idea that, like, Amazon could pick it up and stream everywhere simultaneously and maybe provide it more budget? And maybe I've heard that Jeff Bezos is a personal fan of The Expanse, and he's also mm-hmm. obviously a fan of spaceflight. He's spending hundreds of millions of dollars going through the world's oceans and reclaiming old, you know, Apollo-era rockets, and he's making his own copper rocket that's, you know, trying to compete with Mr. Tesla, Elon Musk. I think it's a natural fit, but it worries me that the talks are still happening. Now, it shouldn't, because any kind of acquisition like this would take a long time to figure out to where they can, like, you know, come to an official announcement. What is your, I guess, what's your feelings on the matter? Like, do you think it's a done deal? Do you think it's going to happen?
My gut feeling is yes. I think the campaign was strong enough. I think it would put Amazon's streaming platform in a pretty good position that it hasn't really been in before.
Right.
Like, it's never taken on like a really popular show. And granted, this isn't the most popular show, but
right.
a show with a lot of fans who are going to come over to Amazon streaming.
A lot of internet cachet.
Yeah. And that's kind of how Netflix built their business into the next phase. You know, they picked up a lot of shows yeah. and saved them, and the fans came over. So my gut feeling is, yes, they want to do it, and they're just hammering out the deal.
I mean, I have yet to see an Amazon original, but if they pick up The Expanse, I fucking guarantee they're going to see yeah. an Amazon original.
And then if they can advertise you to you correctly, they'll get right. you into their other shows.
Right, right. So I guess I'm cautiously optimistic, but it's just, you know, again, until the, you know, I guess I would hate to see everyone kind of lay off the pressure and, you know, stop talking to your friends about it and stop talking about it on social media and stop, you know, sharing all the stuff with the anticipation that Amazon's going to pick it up. And then, mm-hmm. you know, womp, womp, they don't. So seems on like the other hand, it's very hard to it's very hard to sustain like the kind of momentum that I've seen on the campaign.
Yeah.
It's a good thing that it's happening, I guess, during the season and not like 3 months afterwards, because
absolutely.
There's still every week a reason to be excited for the show.
Mm-hmm.
This week is no exception.
And there are a lot of people talking about The Expanse right now, which
right.
lends itself to the excitement. I also think like Amazon probably is in the best position financially to do mm-hmm. it, because they already have the streaming rights to the old
right.
episodes, right? So now, what
I think
happens,
that's international. I think that's not just America. I think that's unless I'm misunderstanding it, that's yeah. that's worldwide.
Right. So what happens if this show goes off the air? Have they paid in advance for like the next seasons? Like, did they pay for these rights as a chunk?
Just
saying,
because
we're going to get the whole show.
That's a great question, because like if Amazon agrees to produce or to pay for the live broadcast rights, does the streaming rights come with that? I would think that'd be a separate deal.
Yeah,
I mean, it'd be strange for an like, and would it be considered an Amazon original at that point, or is it kind of like
I would think so? Yeah,
some kind of syndication deal.
Well, I imagine they'd probably bundle that up yeah. together at that point.
Yeah, I just don't
and
know.
It might be cheaper for Amazon.
I just don't know enough about the business. I don't think anybody does. There's nobody an expert on like online streaming rights and all that. Mm-hmm. And you know, like Amazon and Netflix pretty closely hold like that information about like ratings and whatnot. Maybe that's another kind of cautionary tale. Like what if we get season four at Amazon and we don't have the ratings, or season four on Amazon and we don't have the ratings and The Expanse is still struggling, but we don't know it. So like a future cancellation
right.
might take us by surprise.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I just like, I'm personally invested in seeing this thing get finished and it but unfortunately I don't know, since the show is so expensive, until it becomes like a worldwide phenomenon. And like, if it ever, if I see like the crew there, Rossinati on Entertainment Weekly, and like the subreddit's got 400,000 people actively subscribed, and there's 10,000 mm-hmm. people anytime, like, then I'll start to breathe a sigh of relief, and we see merch and video games and all that kinds of shit. But until then, I'm always going to sweat this show because I love it so much. It's super expensive. It's niche. Mm-hmm. Those are very fragile things in today's entertainment ecosystem. So, I guess keep up the momentum. I haven't seen anything like this. I've seen some other Save the Show campaigns, but nothing that's got this much support. And that's like, you know, it's like being covered on as breaking news, like on a lot of big sites. It's like completely consumed the Reddit community. Those are all good things. So mm-hmm. excellent job, everybody who is leading these efforts and making the fan trailers and all that stuff. Like, you guys are doing the protomolecules work. anything else we want to say before we get to the episode itself?
Nope.
Before we get to the episode, actually, want to do some housekeeping. Tell everybody that don't forget that not only are we doing the episode on The Expanse each week, but we're also covering HBO's Westworld right now. We do two podcasts a week. One immediately after the episode we call it Instant Talk. The first half is for everybody. The second half is just for club members because they can interact with us through chat and ask us questions and, you know, do the things that people do. And then we also have the full podcast on Tuesday. If you missed it, we saw Deadpool last week. We got a full review of that out on baldmove.com. And also, Con of Thrones is this weekend. Tickets still available at conofthrones.net. It's going to be Friday through Sunday. We've got a bunch of panels on Friday and Saturday if you want to come by and see us. There's going to be an official meet and greet during the con, but we're also having an unofficial meetup this Friday at Cafe Herrera, downtown Dallas, because the Con of Thrones is at Dallas. I should have mentioned that. So if you want to give us your best Martian drawl, show up there at Cafe Herrera, downtown Dallas, and say hi. Say hi. That's going to be cool this Friday. But yeah, if you want to get tickets to the con, go to conofthrones.net. And also, we're on Twitch TV, twitch.tv/baldmove. Next week, something that might be exciting to fans of science fiction, we're going to be starting a playthrough of Detroit Become Human, which I think is, you know, obviously the game's not released. It comes out this Friday, but it's like an adventure-style game or a story-driven game where there's multiple protagonists. One of them is a sentient android, kind of right up our alley.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to start that playthrough Monday at 4 p.m., you know, that whole thing will be on Twitch, and we'll probably archive it to youtube.com/baldmove. All right, housekeeping over. So Christian is getting her hair and makeup did. Before she shoos them away to instantly go into a, I guess, system-wide proclamation where she addresses her fellow citizens, saying that their faith has been tested, which is kind of an earmark to Anna, is probably having some say in the speech writing. She casually announces that Ehrenreich's been arrested and the Secretary General has been ousted. And she says it's time for us to choose a new future that people have fought and died for, and to reject the doctrine of vengeance, but to choose peace. And about then, they show the protomolecule jellyfish, and it's starting to spin a structure around one of its tendrils. She says that Earth and Mars and the belt has to join as brothers and sisters and face the unknown together. As the protomolecule forms a massive ring that the text informs us has achieved stable orbit beyond Uranus.
Mm-hmm.
I got a massive, massive ring that stabilized. Okay, yeah, I'm not going to do
that.
No,
please.
All right, so discuss.
I want the lights that Avasarla has for our studio.
I want her fucking jewelry, man.
Her jewelry.
Like, she's wearing so much cut glass. It's like, I don't know. All I know is Superman got a hold of that. He learned the entire history of Krypton. He'd have conversations with his dad. He'd throw one of them to the Antarctic and make his Fortress of Solitude. It's like crazy how much ice is dripping off this woman. I mean, do you see it? Like 6-7 inch bars, just all arrayed.
No, I've gone jewelry blind when it comes to Avasarla, because she does that all the time. It's crazy.
It's true.
I don't know how much time she spends getting ready in the morning.
You know, she's been in that racing jumpsuit so long, I forgot how dolled up she gets.
And she's been doing high G maneuvers. She can't have jewelry on there.
Right. You wear that stuff, it fucking kill you.
Yeah.
That's a lot of information to be dumped. And then from there, we're introduced to the YK, which is a slingshot racer. Now, they don't really explain this to you, but you're given to understand by the context of the series that this is a very small craft that probably does not have an Epstein drive, but instead uses thrusters to subtly nudge itself around the orbits of the moons of, like, Jupiter. And it's kind of like a Kessel run, you know, like the fastest and most direct course. You can set records for how long it takes to circumnavigate the system. He's just set a massive record for Jupiter, but is frustrated that his thunder is being stole by the fucking ring.
Well, he's shooting the ring. What? So this is what the slingshotters have moved on to now.
Mm-hmm.
They used to, like, slingshot themselves way out into space and just mm-hmm. come back, essentially, I think, using gravity wells and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Now they're all trying to shoot the ring on the fastest time. So, like...
Shoot the ring. You're talking about the actual superstructure of the ring.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So for
these 180
that...
days, that's what these people have been doing. Like, he's trying to set a new record through the ring.
I didn't get... I mean, that might be happening was in the books, but in the show, it seems like he's trying... He sets a record for Jupiter, then he goes and sets a record for Saturn, and when he gets stymied again, he decides to shoot the ring as a stunt for his girlfriend. Because all the other shit, like, all the other racers, they're not talking anything about.
Interesting. Okay. I guess I read those new records as, like, he was on pace for a new record through the ring, but I guess that could be wrong.
We get from the ring broadcast that preempts his, I guess, Twitch streaming of his Jupiter record that the UN is putting together a blue panel of religious leaders, intellectuals, and artists. And then it says a few months later, and this is the time where, like, my blood started to boil. He's shredding around the Saturn system, and it's very cool visually. He's going so fast, he gives himself a nosebleed. But again, there's more news from the ring that he's frustrated that Dawes and Johnson have now announced that the OPA is joining the Earth and Mars on their mission to the ring. He gets a message from his girlfriend at Ceres who says, "I'm tired of waiting for you to get home. Your brother understands me." He walks in the background with a totally rocking bod and his skimpy thong.
Thong, Jesus.
Gets his
Christ.
Heart broke. Drinks his own urine.
Double drinks his own urine. Like, accidentally drinks it and then goes, fuck yeah. it. And takes another gulp.
And decides to, like you say, shoot the ring as a way to impress his girlfriend. The other question I had is, like, how do these guys survive for months at a time in this little coffin-sized ship? Like, do they really re-drink their urine? Like, what do they eat?
I mean, that would certainly help reduce the weight of your craft.
This guy ends up rocking, like, a six-month-long beard, but his cut is as fresh as ever, and it's all recently dyed. Like, what all... Can he take a shower in this thing?
Surely not.
Like, I just know what it takes to cross a fucking ocean, like, in 3 or 4 months. Like, what all you got to pack for one person. And, like, even if I say they got, like, perfect waste reclamation, maybe that's the thing. Like, you piss and shit in bags, and it, like, turns it back into its constituent.
I don't know. I don't know how exactly the logistics work.
I mean, he's a skinny dude, so, like, I don't think he takes much. But, yeah, I find myself, like, really interested in, like, well, how the slingshot stuff works. Now we also get a picture of the UN fleet approaching the ring. It says it's been 187 days since the ring formed. The other thing is, I guess we're supposed to understand that the jellyfish deconstructed itself to make this thing.
Yeah.
It's nowhere. Like, at first I thought it was making this thing and then took off, but I think on second watch it's just reconfigured itself into this.
Yeah, I'm not even sure why it goes jellyfish in the first place.
Because you can't jut around the solar system in a ring. Obviously.
Yeah, obviously.
It's just science, man.
Yeah, I guess I would have expected, like, a pillar or some kind of ball. I don't know why it had to be a jellyfish.
I wonder how much it has to do with, like, that was kind of the basic plan of the Arbogast. Like, it was kind of like a dome-shaped thing. So, like, since it's reconfiguring it kind of used that as a blueprint. That was my guess.
Maybe.
As a person who doesn't know what the fuck is going on. Now the other thing that I thought was interesting is as you see the UN fleet approaching, you can see some type of shuttle or barge that is going across the ring boundary. Mm-hmm. So I'll have a question later on about like what exactly triggers this semi-opaque barrier that shreds this poor this poor guy.
Is it Maneo?
Maneo, yeah. Maneo, as his girlfriend says. We also find that there's a camera crew embedded aboard the Rocinante, who is trying to do a documentary about the ship and James Holden, who seems like he's a real dreamboat. Like, all the advertisements for this special, like, show him, like, with his, you know, his overcoat stripped down to his waist, and he's kind of, like, sitting there making a teen beat or tiger beat puppy eyes at the camera. I don't know. There's a whole lot of discussion here with the camera crew. What did you make of it?
I like it, I guess. I'm curious, like, what their goal is. Like, what angle are they approaching this from? Because they're, I mean, obviously, yeah, documentary teams want to get dirt. Mm-hmm. They want to get the real story, as they would call it. But there's always the editing process in the end where the true objective of the documentary comes out. I'm curious what it is, because a lot of people could have a lot of different opinions on James Holden at this point, right?
Right.
I mean, we see him referred to as, like, the hero of the belt.
Hero of the belt. Savior of Mars.
Yeah, savior of Mars. Like, he has done a lot of really good things, but you can see that there's also other opinions on him. And I don't know what the documentary crew's opinion is going to be.
You know, we learn that they use this kind of framework to really catch us up to speed quickly. We find out that the documentary crew is paying for their legal fees because they're in a protracted legal fight with Mars over who actually owns the Rocinante. And they've agreed to pay their legal fees in exchange for access to them. Mm-hmm. We see that Alex is a bit of a camera hound. He really wants to be on camera, and no one's really that interested in him.
No, he's too thirsty.
Where Amos does not want to be on camera, and the camera seems to love him. We also find that they're operating this as an equal one-quarter share. I forget what the term was. Like, was it not commissioned ship or chartered ship or something or other? But they ask, well, there's only three crew members. What happened to Naomi? And Holden says she's on a leave of absence, which leads us to the OPAS Behemoth,
which is
the former Mormon ship Nauvoo.
Yep.
I can't help but think the first book is called Leviathan Wakes, and this ship is called the Behemoth. And I recall from my Bible history that those are the two creatures that God used to put Job in his place. When Job got a little too high and mighty in his suffering, God came out of a fiery whirlwind and started lecturing him about who created the Behemoth and who created the Leviathan. And the Behemoth is widely regarded as being a hippopotamus. The Leviathan is widely regarded as being a Nile crocodile. So these are like two giant beasts. But I wonder, like, is that intentional, that the Ty and Dan take the imagery intentionally, because this is like something that's like an event that's humbling humanity? Or is it just the sick sounding names?
I don't know. It could be that.
What do you think about the name of Behemoth for a starship? To me, a behemoth implies something that's kind of unwieldy and slow and sluggish, but powerful.
I think that describes the Nauvoo.
Okay.
It's meant for a straight line journey, essentially, right?
Right.
I can't imagine it's very maneuverable. It's certainly not built to be a gunship, which is what it's been turned into.
Mm-hmm.
It's an awkward beast.
Do you know what the S in OPAS stands for? Is it Space Fleet, Starfleet, Ship?
Mm-mm.
Okay, because I tried to look it up on the wiki, and I quickly became clear I was going to get spoiled, so yeah. I backed out. If you got feedback, I don't know. I'm digging into these ship names and finding out stuff about it, and like what they possibly could be named for. And I'll be having more of that this later on this episode, because we get a lot of ship names. Mm-hmm. It's approaching the ring as part of the Belters Coalition to explore it. And we see Naomi in Zero G doing her engineering thing. She sees a drug deal go down in the corridors of the ship. And boy, is she Belter Creoling it up.
Yeah, accents in full effect.
She now am I supposed to understand that she is trying to be more Belter than thou? Like, this is kind of a put on?
I'm wondering if it's an affect or if it's something that she just has settled back into now that she's with her old mates.
Yeah, I'm trying to, and I think that's an open question you're supposed to wonder, because the people in the show and the universe are wondering it about her. Like,
yeah,
is the less Belter accent that she wore in the Rasenati kind of like her natural thing, and she was, or was she trying to hide her Belter accent amongst the inners, and now that she's with her people, she's more free, or is she really playing up the Belter aspect because she's the chief engineer of their flagship now?
Right.
I don't know.
There's clearly a political thing going on here about, like, who's captaining the ship, right, and who's crewing this ship, and what affiliations they have, right? We see that later with, you know, the captain and the other captain, I'll call him.
Right.
I don't remember his name, but other captain seems to think it's all
Ashford,
political.
Ashford, I think, is his name.
Ashford, yes. That's right.
So she sees this drug deal go down, and she kind of busts her chops. But, you know, Belters, they're a rough and ready bunch, and they admire their independence and freedom. And he kind of low-key throws shade at her for being like, well, maybe the parts of Tycho Station you hang out, they don't do drugs. But down here, we do pixie dust 24/7.
Mm-hmm.
And she goes, well, I don't want to see it where people are working. And the dealer says, you got no trouble for me, boss man. And that's it.
She's got purple in her hair, too.
Naomi?
Uh-huh.
I didn't notice that.
Yeah.
Because I was probably distracted by the purpleness of her jumpsuit. The Behemoth fires up its engines in the next scene. I thought it was a really cool shot where you can see, like, to give an idea of the acceleration, it kind of, like, fairly leaps away from some of its escort craft.
Hmm.
I thought that was pretty cool. You also pan over and you can see some hastily erected railgun and PDC batteries and emplacements,
mm-hmm,
which is kind of neat. It reminds me a lot of, like, what they say about the Mon Calamari warships from, like, Star Wars, that they were essentially like pleasure cruisers that were hastily retrofitted with shields and weapons, because these are just essentially welded on. It does not look like it's designed for this. We see Drummer walking with Naomi to greet someone that just landed, and they're bitching about how Anderson Dawes is taking the credit for all their hard work. But Naomi says that she's got Drummer's back, and we're introduced to Commander Claus Ashford, who asked permission to come aboard. What do you make of this guy?
I've seen him in many, many things.
Mm-hmm.
The
one that I know...
I'm worried about this guy.
The thing that he's probably most famous for is Good Night and Good Luck.
Yes.
He's okay. David Strathairn. Strathairn, I think, is how you pronounce it.
Hmm.
He's a famous character actor. He's been in tons of shit in TV and movies. But like I said, Good Night and Good Luck is probably his most famous role.
I like him. He would not have been my first choice for Ashford, but... I don't know if it's like the intense scarring they put on him, but they're really doing... He's doing a lot with this character.
Yes.
And I think it's mostly good. I think I like it.
Also, I gotta say that not having subtitles with this much Belter Creole is
Christ.
A challenge.
Yeah.
I did so much fast forward and rewinding to try to figure out exactly what these people are saying.
Yeah.
But again,
I find it's better when dealing with the Belter Creole to just kind of let
kind
it
of
wash
go with
over
the flow.
You.
Yeah.
And by the end of what their sentence, you'll get the context.
Right.
Yeah.
But I think he's interesting because he's obviously, as you said, very heavily scarred. He's been through a lot. He's very hard bitten, tough as nails. And I had an apprehension about him because I naturally I like Drummer and I like Naomi, and here's this interloper.
Mm-hmm.
But by the end of the episode, I found that like I was really agreeing with a lot that he was putting down.
Yeah, he seems to be a calming force on the station in some ways.
Uh-huh.
Other ways, not so much. He clearly has a past with people.
Right.
But I think that also brings with it a certain amount of respect.
There's a lot of intimations here about, you know, because Drummer at one point accuses him of being a pirate, and he kind mm-hmm. of low-key accuses her of being a dark skies terrorist.
And he comes in sounding like a pirate. Doesn't he, like, first thing he says is yar or something?
Probably.
Or a vast.
And then we see kind of a dick power play by Anderson Dawes. He's forced Diogo Harari, last seen fucking over Fred Johnson for the scientist, mm-hmm. The protomolecule scientist, Cortazar. And he's a lieutenant on board the ship. And he starts taunting Naomi almost right away, saying, hey, Cortazar says hi, before Asher shuts him down hard for disrespecting her and his commanding officer. And he says, you're a lieutenant, you need to start acting like it. And he seems appropriately chastened.
Yeah. Diogo's a free spirit, we'll call him, though.
Yeah.
And I don't know what's going to happen face. With Diogo.
He's got they've got matching OPA kind of black uniforms, which Naomi and Drummer kind of make fun of. But he says, I prefer it to the clothes of indentured servitude. Hmm. And yeah, pretty prickly reception here between our command staff. not like any Star Trek I've ever seen. Then we are on board the UNN Thomas Prince, which I looked up. Thomas Prince is an American scholar and historian, noted for pioneering the art of scientific history, and wrote a series of books describing the history of New England. He set out to chronicle the history of New England from the sixth day of creation to the present day, which was the mid-18th century at the time. So yeah, I'm not sure. So I also think this is a research vessel. It's not like a military vessel, because the uniforms that they wear remind me of like the uniforms the crew of the Arbogast wore.
This is the one that Anna's on?
Yeah. So like that would all make sense that it bears the name of like a scientist and historian than some kind of military or religious or political figure.
They're essentially just out there to look at and discuss and sort of try and figure out the ring, right?
Right.
Is my impression of this?
Right. And it's
and they have like religious people, they have scientists.
It's very much like
historians.
Contact, right? Freaky first contact, so let's get all the religious people to pacify that contingent. Let's get the intellectuals who are actually going to do the work. Let's get the artists so they can inspire. And also, you know, all those perspectives are probably equally valid, because you're dealing with an alien civilization who could have all those aspects of. Mm-hmm. Like, who's to say that the proto-molecule, they might be all kinds of deists. Maybe they're gods themselves. You want really just people in there to discuss the... Anna seems to have landed on her feet after all this debacle. She's earned her place on the blue ribbon panel with a few strings pulled by Avasarala. Almost seems like she is strong-armed. Or I made an offer she can't refuse, which appears to be like full to-the-hilt funding. Not this bullshit that the mm-hmm. Former Secretary General is pulling, but full to-the-hilt funding for her clinic for undocumented. She discusses with, I don't know who this guy is, whether he's the captain of the Prince or he's just a fellow scientist or what. I think he's definitely the intellectual detachment, because he kind of blows her shit about being the religious contingent.
Yeah.
But she rejoins, like, look, I came here on a spaceship, not on the wings of an angel. I understand the difference, which kind of mollifies him. And they do a bunch of, like, a data dump where I don't know that we knew that the protomolecule was discovered inside Phoebe, the moon of Saturn, until this point. I didn't remember it if we did. Do you want to hear some facts about Phoebe that might be relevant to the show?
Okay, sure.
So Phoebe is a regular shaped moon that's 200 miles across, which is borderline size for gravity to be able to compress something into a sphere. Scientists think that one time it was spherical, but has been battered into its present lumpy shape by frequent collisions with other heavenly bodies. It's also distinguished as the first moon to be discovered through photography back in 1899. It eluded discovery for such a long time because it's one of the darker objects in the solar system. It's got the reflectivity of like the soot that forms in lamp glass. It's called lamp black. So it's very hard to discover. And we know a surprising amount about it, because it was one of the first things targeted by the Cassini probe mission back in 2004. So it got a close flyby, and we've mapped the entire surface of it. And scientists have thus thought that it's actually did not form with Saturn or the rest of the moons, but it's actually a captured Centaur object from the Kuiper belt.
Yeah, which is kind of like probably the spawn of this idea that Phoebe would be the plant for the protomolecule.
Like that's the farthest outside the solar system you can get and still be called a solar system object. Mm-hmm. So it's like something very far and remote and dark that's been captured inside our system, and this thing has been dormant there for God knows how long. But I think that's kind of cool that and a centaur object is called a centaur. I didn't know this either, because it combines the attributes of an asteroid, which is a primary rocky object, and the attributes of a comet, which is a primarily ice object. And scientists think it's about 50-50 of both. And that's why they call it a centaur, because it's half one thing, half the other.
Interesting.
So there you go. And that's the reason why it's a good proto-molecule thing is because it did come from so far, and now it's inside the solar system. And I thought that was pretty cool. Mm-hmm. And this guy's opinion is, this is a piece of technology that an intelligence created, an extremely intelligent intelligence, and we should pray that it is inert.
Hmm.
It does seem like it is. Like, it's not glowing blue. It's just sitting out there.
I don't know why he assumes that it's a thing that an intelligence created. Because someone could look at us and say that must be the case, but
right.
He would know better than that.
Right.
Why couldn't this thing have evolved independently?
Right. Or if you look at, like, the intricate structures of, like, plankton and whatnot, like, nature does all kinds of funky engineered-looking things all the time.
I don't know why this guy is making the assumption that it was created by intelligence.
Your fair point. Anna should have called him on that.
She should have, yeah.
Intelligent design, really,
literally know nothing of its origins. Why would you jump to conclusions?
Let's assume it was manufactured.
Right.
By an intelligence. I mean, it's clearly manufactured. But it's by the intelligence. It
could be by natural processes.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, you know, a honeybee's hive is constructed, but not by an intelligence.
That's fair.
So that's that. We're back on to Rocinante, and Alex is trying to drum up his latest attempt to get on camera by making stroganoff with fake beef, fake noodles, but real mushrooms. The reporter tries to talk to Alex about his family, which doesn't really lead anywhere. We find he's still on good terms with his boy, and they, you know, talk remotely a lot. She shifts then to Amos, which this is where I start to lean forward in my seat, because it reveals that he got his commission or his apprenticeship through this lottery system. Can you explain the backstory in the lottery system? Because this is the first I've really heard of it.
No.
From a book reader's perspective.
I can't.
Huh. So apparently, I'm going to make all this shit up from the context.
I have a feeling.
Can you speculate, Mr. Data?
I have a feeling that it's probably in the novella, The Churn.
Oh, really?
Because that deals, I think, with Amos' backstory in Baltimore and stuff.
Oh, so this isn't like a main sequence of books? There's like digressions?
Not that I've gotten to yet, no.
Interesting. Okay.
Oh, you mean like...
I'm saying like, yeah, like...
So they have like a main series of novels, which is planned to be 9. It's 7 right now.
Mm-hmm.
And then they do a series of novellas, which are kind of scattered through the timeline of the novels. And The Churn is one of the first ones, I think. Maybe the first one.
Is there a recommended order of reading? Like, are you supposed to read them? Like...
I think The Churn is right after the first book.
Huh.
Between the first and second.
But you just decided, like, what?
I was just going to mainline the novels and then go back and fill in the gaps because I felt like the novellas really didn't need to be read.
Right. They should be supplementary information. Yeah. Well, I'm going to try to extrapolate that there is a lottery system to give people living on basic hope that they can actually, you know, it replaces like the American dream. There's some hope of upward mobility.
Like a job lottery kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Amos.
Not like the Hunger Games.
Not like the. But she finds out that there's no official government records for this Amos character, just a birth certificate and the fact that he registered a lottery win when he was 15. But she also mentions that in the Baltimore area, there used to be an Amos Burton that was a mob boss.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point, Amos smashes the camera and tells the reporter to not get so close.
Yeah, not a good idea, Amos. You're giving things away.
The first time I watched, I was just like really absorbing this information. I thought she was implying that Amos was the crime boss, but now I think she's implying that Amos killed the crime boss and took his identity and rigged a lottery to get off world. Which
I guess
jibes with the fact that he had to die to get away. I wonder what his real aim is, and if we'll ever find that out.
But also, it would jive if he was the mob boss and he just switched identities.
But he's 15. I don't buy a 15-year-old mob boss.
I guess he wouldn't be switching identities if he were Amos Burton in both places.
Right. What's the odds?
No, I'm a different Amos Burton.
Right.
That sounds right.
The reporter then tries to seduce. I just think that, like, the Amos I know doesn't seem like he's a mob boss.
Yeah, I'm with you. That felt a little weird because I thought he was the mob boss.
Right. Like, I think he wants to be left alone. He probably wants to eat and he wants to fuck and he wants to drink. But I don't think he would, like, fucking run a city.
But he is cold-blooded.
He is.
Like, I could see that being a valuable quality.
But they made him into a big follower, like he's more of a follower than a leader at this point. So that doesn't scream mob boss to me. But
yeah,
at any rate, the reporter tries to seduce him. But after he gets her all kind of hot and bothered, he leans in and whispers into his ear that he doesn't shit where he eats, which pretty glorious. Pretty glorious. Anything else we want to say about that?
I don't think so.
The cameraman threatens Amos that he's going to have to pay for that camera. I don't think he's going to make good on that threat.
Yeah.
that's just my personal opinion. Naomi gives a technical briefing to Ashford and Drummer. She says that she has the missile and PDC batteries functional but untested, and the railguns are as yet not operational. My ears perk up because anytime they tell us something like that, it's got to be for a reason.
Yeah.
I'm expecting some misfortunes to befall the vessel in the near future.
Mildly interesting.
It appears that Ashford approves of the fact that the Belt has stolen the behemoth from the Mormons, and Drummer ironically observes, oh, what a surprise, a pirate that supports an act of piracy. But he says, no, I'm a patriot. This warship is a symbol, the greatest vessel ever built in history and built by Belters, and that the Inners cannot ignore that, which... is true. They didn't pay for it, but it is Belter engineering and know-how and expertise.
Yep.
We get to see the bridge, and it's still pretty Mormony, but they're clearly, like, you know, running cables everywhere and, like, fucking up the aesthetics. And I noticed there's lots of, like, the artwork has been vandalized by OPA sprays and stuff. Ashford goes up to this guy named Gregory to say hi, and he ends up choke slamming him to the ground. Before explaining that, hey, I'm just here to apologize and we're good, and we find that they used to work together.
You think they're good? You think they're good now?
I think if Gregory knows what's good for him, they'll be good.
Yeah.
That's like, and it also shows that Ashford is kind of a guy to be reckoned with, because I thought if I had to pick one before, I would have probably picked Gregory in the fight.
He's more stout, certainly.
Yeah, maybe even got a little size and reach, but Ashford's wily. And wiry. Mm-hmm. And scarred. He's just like a piece of beef jerky in a spacesuit. And you don't want to fuck with him. This causes Drummer to pull him aside to talk to him. And they do... This is this weird banter where he kind of like... facetiously asks about her wound that she sustained in that OPA attack. And he says that was an unauthorized Black Sky operation that neither him or Dawes had any knowledge with. Anything to do with, which Drummer doesn't really believe.
Yeah, I don't know if I believe that.
I don't either.
Like, how close is Anderson to Black Sky?
And also, why is Anderson continuing to be, like... I understand him jockeying for position, but some of this stuff, like, you know, putting the kid as a lieutenant, like, some of this stuff feels like a deliberate provocation.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, that's entirely within Dawes's character. And I guess Johnson, I mean, he's going to fuck over somebody's going to fuck over somebody here. It's got to happen. Then they have this kind of like weird dueling argument where they both acknowledge that they think that that they both think they should be captain. And that's an inherently unstable thing. And neither Dawson or Dawes nor John. Dawson. Let's go with Dawes. Like Johnson and Dawes are Dawson.
They're Dawson from now on.
Dawson, neither one of them really care about Drummer and Ashford's working comfort. But they're going to agree to work together for the good of the Belter State.
Yeah, so Ashford is her number two at this point, right?
Yeah, second in command. He does seem like he has more experience, maybe more political savvy.
Yeah.
But I think...
And there's this political argument that they have over why she's captain. You know,
right.
it very much seems like this is some kind of maneuver on Dawson's part.
Well, I mean, I think from Fred Johnson's perspective, like, he's the one, like, yes, you have this protomolecule scientist, but I have the protomolecule and I have the behemoth. There's no fucking way I'm going to put your pirate in charge of the ship. Like, second command's best I can do. It's a Pawn Stars type of operation. And yeah. Dawes, like, I think that some of the reason Dawes is trying to destabilize this is probably, if I'm reading the tea leaves, is to come up with some kind of bullshit excuse to, like, take command in the future, like, citing Drummond's hot-headedness or Drummer's hot-headedness and, like, inexperience. And, you know, I'm sure she'll commit various political snafus. What else we want to talk about? Oh, at this point, we get an alarm klaxon goes off. We find that a construction skiff is gone into a hard spin and is on a collision course with Behemoth. But no problem, because Naomi managed to hack into the controls remotely and bring it in for a smooth dock. But we find out the guy's already dead because of the high G maneuvers. And he's also the guy who was getting high in pixie dust.
Yeah. Is dun, the, dun, dun. Is it the high G or is it the pixie dust that did him in?
Probably a little bit of column A, a little bit of column
yeah.
B.
Yeah, pixie dust led to a slip up that put him in a spin and killed
him. That then killed him because he wasn't, you know, you can't get high when you're out there in the black, man. No,
and that's the point that Naomi makes, you know. These drugs are causing problems.
We then are introduced to the MCRN Zusen. Zusen is one of the pioneers of China's space and rocketry program, who passed away in 2009 at the age of 97.
Jesus.
What's interesting about him is he immigrated to America, graduated from MIT, and worked in America's space program until the 1950s, when he was drummed out on trumped-up charges of communist sympathy.
Yeah.
Jailed for 5 years, and then exchanged for Korean POWs, where he then became the grandfather of China's rocketry program, led them to invent nuclear weapons, and they had the fastest turnaround from fission to fusion ever, and made China into a nuclear superpower and increasingly a space superpower.
This is why witch hunts are bad.
And what I'm saying is, like, this is also so great for this show, because it's like,
sure, yeah,
bullshit, stupid political games can blow up in your fucking face and turn friends into enemies, and then give those enemies a massive leg up that you wouldn't want them to have. So, like, pretty delicious naming there. But the reason we're interested in the Zusen is because Bobby's aboard. This is her new post,
and she's got to be in this area.
Yes.
She's real close because it's real-time communication.
It's real-time communication.
Alex.
Yep.
So she might be at the ring herself.
The thing says it's approaching the ring.
Oh, okay, cool.
So, yeah. And we learn a lot of stuff. Some stuff I'm happy about, some stuff I'm not happy about. She reveals that she's been reinstated as a Marine, which kind of bums me out because I was really hoping she'd be another Black Sheep member of the Rasenati.
Yeah.
We also find out that she dropped in on Alex's family. I'm a little confused because on the one hand, she said she hasn't been back to Mars since way back when, like implying like since like season two, essentially. But she also checked in on Alex's family. So, and that could be less than 187 days ago. So I'm not sure if that meant she just used like her official channels to like drop him a line, but fuck, Alex can do that.
Right.
So
yeah.
I don't get it. I don't fully understand that interaction. Alex also reveals that his wife has filed for divorce, and he says he feels relieved about it. She says...
He's got one family now.
Right. And she says that despite what her fellow Martians believe about the Rasenati, she thinks that he's earned his seat and he's a top-notch pilot. It's revealed that there's a film crew filming this whole thing. So I don't know what the hell that means. What did you make of this interaction? Because I felt like the show was low key shipping Bobby and Alex two episodes ago, and this interaction was, I felt, calculated to just keep walking that line.
Yeah, I could see that,
because Bobby was a little bit more interested in Alex and his thoughts about the divorce, and like Alex seemed like he was disappointed when she had to go, and they've maintained this relationship, which, you know, it makes it makes perfect sense because they're both Martians,
and more importantly, Bobby was like smiling and laughing, and it's a side of Bobby that we don't often see.
Right.
I don't know if that says, hey, they're interested in each other romantically, or if that's just a friendship thing.
That's the thing. Like, it's like, because it's not like they're saying baby or sweet or anything like that. And but you know, now Alex, as like, it's pointed that, that Alex is now divorced and he's potentially going to be free to pursue a relationship, and there is this kind of like cutesy thing between them. Tell me when she comes back to the Rossinati. Right now.
Here's the thing.
I want to hear this mildly interesting shit. When does Bobby come back?
No mildly interesting. I legitimately don't know, because
well, you're about to spoil by omission.
We are beyond the Bobby stuff that I'm aware of now.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. All right.
Is one of the most interesting plots to me.
What do you think about the film? Good, so you can speculate. What do you think about the film crew filming? To me, maybe this is going to get her into some political hot water because she's expressing sympathy for this Martian traitor.
She does, say, don't tell the crew or whatever, but I think you're awesome.
Right.
They clearly are going to have an agenda when it comes to each person on this ship.
Yeah.
In portraying they are.
And maybe the ship as a whole.
Yes. And like I said, I'm really curious to see where they land on that.
Yeah. That was an interesting scene. We then go back to the behemoth, and Naomi is confessing to Drummer that she knew about the drug problem before it became a problem, and she thinks it's a lapse in her judgment, but Drummer doesn't agree because, you know, Belters are free to do whatever the hell Belters want to do up until that freedom fucks with her agenda. And then you gotta deal with the problem. And she goes, asks who the dealer is, and she goes stomping off with a head of steam, and Ashford observes that and sends Diogo after her to kind of tail her. This is going to set up a whole bunch of command crisis here in a minute. Back on board the Prince, Anna is talking. She's not talking. She's getting a message, because obviously the delay is out in Uranus. Must be immense. Must be several hours of lag. But her wife confirms that Avasarala is funding her clinic to the hilt, which makes her happy. But she's also feeling very low since Anna's been gone for so long, and she's so far away, and she's afraid, and she misses her. And that's a pretty good scene. It seems to deliver a blow to Anna.
Yeah, she's going to an inherently dangerous place.
Yeah.
The unknown.
And this is something she's supposed to be just away for a few weeks for a speech, and now it's turned into this thing. Like, I can totally see her wife's objection to, like, yeah, it's great that her clinic's founded, but, like, I'd rather have my wife back, and so would our daughter.
Yeah.
We then, in the background, see a fleet service team being dispatched from the Prince on a repair skiff. We're introduced to Melba, who is a female technician that is very new. She's a rookie to the job. The other crew kind of teases her about, you know, clocking in before the shower, the appropriate ways to bilk the clock for time. There's some discussion about Holden's documentary, and she gives her opinion that she thinks Holden's a narcissistic asshole.
Clock in 4 minutes after your scheduled time and clock out four minutes before. That's what I know.
Yep. you know, it's like, what? Like, because I used to make, because in not stealing from work, but when I was a Jehovah's
FedEx?
Witness, no. When I was a Jehovah's Witness, I used to joke about, like, the way you counted your time in field service.
Yeah.
And it pissed, because, like, there's, like, a particular woman who was, like, a real stickler for that shit. Like, she would, like, clock out for, like, when you took a gas break or bathroom break. And I would, like, always tease her, like, I don't know, as soon as the alarm goes off. And she's like, that's stealing from Jehovah. And I'm like, well, whose time am I on? I'm not waking up for me.
Yeah.
So, like, when the alarm goes off, my eyes open, I'm on the clock, you know.
Yeah.
It's always funny to fuck with people who've got sticks up their asses. This is going to be significant here in a bit. They dock with the UNN Sung Yoon, which, as far as I can tell, is a Korean actress. So I'm going to, that's like the Agatha King. I'm going to say that's a person that's important in the future, which I really enjoy that at about The Expanse. Like, you get some Hammurabis. You get some, you know, ancient rocket
back.
Huh? It is back at the end of this episode.
Yeah.
You get a mix of, like, actual real historical characters, like Prince, and then you've got these, like, people who the hell knows they are. But, like, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Because, like, imagine in the 1900s reading speculative fiction about a carrier named the Ronald Reagan. You're like, who the fuck is the Ronald Reagan?
Yeah.
You know? Well, it hasn't happened yet. It's in our shared future. So they dock with this ship, and it's described as a fleet support ship, so I don't know what the hell it's actually doing, but they're doing some kind of servicing to the mechanicals of the ship, and it doesn't really matter because the whole point is she's new at her job, she's very apprehensive, and she's attaching a bomb to the inside of this ship. Now, it almost implied like the bomb was already there and she was maintaining it.
Yeah, it was kind of a weird
introduction. It's a weird cut. Like, it's almost like it was already attached and she deattached it and maybe refueled or something. I don't know. But there's a bomb that she was associated with maintaining or planting on this UNN ship. Mm-hmm. And she's also sweating bullets, like literally, like just sweat pouring off her because she's nervous. And she's looking shady as shit while she's doing it.
Oh, yeah.
Back on the roster.
And she almost fucks everything up, too. Like, she's so new at this.
Yeah.
She almost puts this thing in backwards and...
Yeah. Like, that's the thing. Like, there's so much tension about her being discovered throughout this episode. Mm-hmm. What's kind of... It's weird. It's, like, fake tension, because I don't really care about her, nor do I care about her crew chief, but it's, like, it's a trick of the show where it's, like, they play the ominous music, and she's sweating bullets, and, oh, my God, she's going to be discovered. What does that mean? And then I'm, like, why do I care or know at this point? Mm-hmm. Just settle down. So back on to Rasanadi, the camera guy, who... appears to be blind, but has surgically implanted sensors in his hands.
Yeah, what's with the hands and the, like, is he seeing through the cameras? Is he seeing through his fingers?
It seems like a little bit of both. Like, he can control the drone with his hands, but he can also, like, he was using his hands to tell what plant that Alex was fucking with in the galley of the ship.
Yeah, how does he see, even? You know, does he see as we see, or does he get, like, some other sensory inputs?
We need to see some Geordi LaForge cam. We need to see, like, what this all looks like.
Yeah, I forget. What did his look like? Just all sorts of crazy
spectrums.
Sometimes
it was IR. Yeah. Sometimes it was, like, you know, it's just whatever the technology at the time would easily allow them to do in syndication or a big-budget motion picture.
Right.
And whether he's wearing the visor or his fucking weird cortical implants. Mm-hmm. That's how he sees the world. That's how this guy do. And he tries to, they talk about Prax, and there's a sweet scene where Amos says he was good company and his best friend in the whole world, but he left to help rebuild the Ganymede station, and Amos is not the rebuilding type. But there's also a line in there about Prax didn't ask him to come with, but... Amos took it like he didn't ask because he knew Amos would turn him down. I don't know if I believe that. What's your take on the situation? What's your read on the relationship?
I don't even remember that line.
This guy's trying to start shit, too. So he asks about Prax, and then, like, well, if you're such good buddies, why didn't you go with him to Ganymede? And then he tries to seduce Amos. And Amos just rebuffs him the same way he did the attractive reporter, saying that he doesn't shit where he eats.
Yeah, this camera crew is relentless.
Yeah, man.
This documentary crew. I did not know, like, the documentary crews were just so easy.
Yeah,
know?
They're like, you know, they're full-time documentarians, part-time sex workers.
Yeah.
Like, you know, we'll trade access for sex.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. So there's nothing in here, and they have been, I've noticed this season, playing with Amos's definition of, like, masculinity and sexuality, because we found out he wears pumps on occasion.
Oh, right, yeah.
You know, he grew up in a whorehouse, it sounds like. And, he doesn't, like, say he's not gay or bisexual. He just says he doesn't shit where he eats. But you also know that he would have fucked Naomi if she'd asked.
Would have, yeah.
So, like...
But he might have also fucked Holden if he asked.
But that's what I'm saying. Like, I think Amos, the idea of Amos as, like, some kind of pansexual badass is kind of intriguing. I dig it. But yeah, he doesn't get anywhere with this guy. I think this whole scene is just to show what happened to Prax.
Yep.
The crew chief goes back to check on Malba's work and make some minor corrections to her. Like, she's putting in some shit backwards and all that stuff. And, like, he keeps coming. And if this had powered up, then we'd have to go to this panel that's got the bomb behind it. And,
right.
And she's like, and pulling out her collar. And it's pretty hilarious.
It is. Yeah. It's a little bit cheesy.
Yeah. Drummer is kicking, so we see Drummer preceding this procession of, like, this military police guy kicking the drug dealer supplier throughout the corridors of the ship and into the nearest airlock. Naomi goes to confront her and saying, you can't do this. Ashford then shows up and agrees with her. He doesn't deny that he's spaced a belt or three in his lifetime, but says now's the time we got to grow up and start acting like people who obey the rule of a law.
Now is their moment.
He's
right about that.
I agree. I'm actually kind of shocked that Drummer is this one note. But on the other hand, why can't the Belters be taken seriously? Like, why are they not allowed to have their own justice system, I guess? Because the Belt is not Earth.
Sure.
Like, if you fuck up on your job at Earth, something goes wrong, sure, but like hundreds and thousands of people probably won't die. Whereas if you fuck up out on the belt, like it's just a, I feel like any environment that's more hostile is going to have slightly looser regulations. Like look at Mars, you got kids going out with a spacesuit unsupervised. Mm-hmm. That's horrifically dangerous, but it's Mars.
Sure. I think the key thing here that I'm picking up is that Fred is kind of influencing this, and that we've seen Fred's goal all along is to be taken seriously by the other powers in the system, right?
So that's I guess what surprised me is Ashford seems to be carrying Fred Johnson's water.
Yeah.
And Drummer seems to be carrying Anderson Dawes, like, not giving a fuck and spacing people and being Belters. What's up with that?
I don't know. I'm not sure where Drummer's coming from exactly, other than to say she is still probably fairly angry at Johnson.
So maybe this is acting out to like doing something like, hey, you put me in command, so I'm gonna do something I know you wouldn't approve of. To
could be,
or maybe it's not even that conscious, it's just like this is how she would dispense justice.
No, but the thing I really like about this whole scenario here, what they've set up in this episode with the OPA trying to be taken seriously, is just the perception of it. You don't often deal in TV shows with like larger perceptions of factions, right?
Yeah.
You deal with like personal politics and how is Frank Underwood going to get out of this thing?
Right,
but like
right.
The perception of a faction of the solar system is really interesting because, you know, they have long been not taken seriously at all.
Mm-hmm.
And walked all over, and Fred Johnson is trying to change that, and he has to change both the outside perception and also the way that the Belters and the OPA view themselves.
Right.
And that is not an easy thing to do.
Right.
And
right.
I feel like with the Nauvoo and Ashford, he's trying to do something that is bigger than just this moment.
Yeah, and there's a lot of echoes in real-life politics. Like, this is very analogous to, like, the Palestinian Authority versus Hamas. You know, you've got, like, the legitimate government. They're in a tough spot. But you also have this, like, terrorist wing that's trying to, like, reform their ways. But maybe, are they? And they're still, like, and then you've got the... It's fucked up, and it's really hard to, like, if you start to peel back the layers of blame and provocation and violence, and you can go back, like, literally 100 years.
Right.
And it's interesting to see kind of, like, you know, this is very analogous as that this situation as well. Because you're right. It's not just about changing how Earth and Mars see the belt. It's changing, like you said, how Belters see themselves and how they conduct themselves.
Yeah.
And whether that's something they even want to do, because it's not something you can really force top down. You can lead and inspire, and that's about it.
Right. And I think that's what he's trying to do here. You know, he's not saying we're going to airlock anybody who has contraband because we don't do contraband anymore. He's saying, look, give it up because we're trying to make a statement here to the rest of the system.
So that's the thing. Like, Drummer starts off after she's talked to. She says, all right, we're going to leave this airlock open for one shift. Any contraband in there, fine. But anything after, and he cuts her off and says, we're going to court-martial you, send you back to Ceres, and imprison you on a prison barge.
Yeah.
I would not have guessed at the start of this episode that by the end of it, I'd think, you know what? I think Ashford would be the better commander.
But he
Well be. I think he would be a much better first and her the much better second.
She's used to that role.
Yeah.
She's very used to that role. I think command is new for her.
On the other hand, I think it would be more interesting for Drummer for her to stretch and grow and learn and like to earn the respect of this guy.
And I think that Ashford can be a good guide for her into that role.
No, I mean, his political instincts are so much better than Drummer's.
Yeah.
I don't know, but I like Drummer. I'm worried for her future because it seems like she could really easily be caught up in these political machinations and be the odd woman out. So now we got the slingshot pilot who somehow has a half year's worth of beard growth, but still has perfectly cut hair and a fresh dye job. His girlfriend tight beams him and says if he pulls off this crazy stunt that she'll be waiting for him, which he gets back, and then it's implied that she flashes her titties on him, which gets a pretty big reaction from him. He's excited.
Let's say an equal and opposite reaction.
Equal and opposite reaction. That's right. Right. The ship slows down imperceptibly from the explosive erection that he just got.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly what happened.
I was wondering, like, as he's sliding around in this ship, is that going to change his trajectory at all? But I guess not.
Yeah.
It wouldn't.
I'm also wondering, because we get the censored version of all this stuff.
Yeah.
And so I was wondering, like, there surely is not going to get away with, like,
I don't think they're going to show. I
mean, you can get away with like, I think TV-14, you can get away with some, like, Titanic-style titties.
Maybe.
Like, if they're tastefully and artistically done, if they're drawn like some French girl.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I'm pretty excited about a potential TAMA version of The Expanse, or TVMA.
Oh,
right?
Yeah,
I said
yeah.
TA.
TNA.
Going to a company like Amazon, mm-hmm. you don't have to have the censored versions. You can just give it the full meal deal. On the other hand, I'm about this close to letting Jack watch this whole fucking series, and uh-huh. that would probably push that plan back a couple years if they went full TVMA.
Yeah.
So Ashford then kind of saddles up to Naomi he saddles up to Drummer and says, hey, this is a small step, but it's a step forward, because they're looking at, like, all of this contraband getting piled into the airlock.
Yeah.
But Drummer petulantly says, this is just not who we are, and kind of storms off. So then Ashford asks Naomi who we should be. And he says that she was a radical who was betrayed, who hit out with the Inners and is a hero. And ask why she's here, and she says it's time for the Belters to stand up. And he goes, well, you should explain that to Drummer.
Mm-hmm.
Can Naomi do that without making Drummer feel even more isolated? That's what I worry about.
Yeah, it's going to be a tough line to walk, because they are, for lack of a better term, friends.
And whole first half of this episode, I've got your back.
Mm-hmm.
You better. I'm your captain. And this guy who has just undercut her authority, justifiably, Naomi's going to take up for him?
She's got to be very tactful about it.
Very, very. It's a tall, because the other thing is, like, Drummer's not the easiest person to placate. Mm-hmm. Like, I think she's kind of bristly and hostile and didn't even want this job in the first place, so she's, like, perpetually cranky about it.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see how Naomi can walk that tightrope. And also, like, I don't know. Maybe Ashford should do the lion's share of this, like, convincing work and leave Naomi out of it,
mm-hmm.
or let her be the honest broker, because, like, I don't think he's particularly even trying to. I mean, like I said, he just, like, talked right over her in front of all those other Belters.
Yeah. I think it's going to be interesting to see where Naomi's loyalties lie. You know, how on board is she with the general feelings of the OPA, as led by Dawson,
mm-hmm.
And how much is she going to be a Belter?
Mm.
You know, I think there's going to be a tension there between, like, she's kind of caught in the middle, you know, between mm. Ashford and Drummer,
mm-hmm.
and I think that's going to be a struggle for her.
What I think is going to happen is Drummer's going to throw in an airlock and a spacesuit, space her, and then she'll get back on Rossinati.
Okay.
Yeah. And then they'll get out that Bobby is stumping for this Martian renegade, and her crew is going to throw her in a spacesuit, space her, and then the gang will be back together.
Avra Sarla gets spaced off of her.
Yep, she mouths off to the wrong diplomat. She gets spaced.
Prax off the enemy.
Prax is going to get spaced off the moon. I don't even know how that going to be loaded into a magnetic... What do they call that? Like a railgun launch system and launched off the moon.
Yeah, like a magnetic coaster
into a stable Uranus orbit, and mm-hmm. he'll get picked up, and then Bob's your uncle. The gang's back together.
A mass driver. They just put him in a mass driver.
Just
yeah,
put him in a mass. He's a mass. Put him. Cause, you know, I was thinking. I didn't see any of this coming. The crew being completely torn apart.
Yeah,
but I did have a lot of reservations about what it's going to be like having May aboard the ship. this whole time.
Mm, yeah, now, that would be weird.
I guess May is not infected with a protomolecule, because that would have come up if she was, like...
Yeah, within 6 months, I think she probably would be dead.
Right. Or she would at least be, like, Prax would be saying, like, yeah, May's glowing like a blue light bulb or something. Yeah. But yeah, like, I was kind of concerned about what it would do to the tone of the show to have a 9-year-old girl on board the Rasenati. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't, like, digging it.
Yeah, they didn't go that way.
Maybe just won't see Prax again. That'd be kind of sad.
Maybe not.
So the crew is cleaning out of the Sung-un when the chief remembers that he forgot his flask, because he's the kind of crew chief that likes taking nips on the job.
Scotty.
My kind of crew chief. He sees that Malba has left behind a tool. Then he sees some evidence that a hatch was tampered with. What a noob. You don't clean up your tools and you fuck up and scratch up the bulkhead. Really sloppy work here, Malba. He investigates and finds Malba's bomb, and of course she's hung back to confront him about it and regretfully asks why he had the look. He briefly tries to talk himself out of the situation, says, hey, I've been in fights before. I don't want to have to hurt you. She bites down on what I think is a false tooth that releases some kind of crazy-ass adrenaline-jacking stuff that makes her temporarily super strong, and she beats this man down. Smashes his head like a tomato can against a bulkhead, and it instantly collapses.
Yeah, she does. It's wild.
Yeah, so this episode has got me thinking about a lot of different science fiction. Are you familiar with, like, Larry Niven's Man-Kazin Wars or Ringworld?
I read the first Ringworld
book.
Did
you really?
Yeah.
Okay, so you're familiar with the Kazin, which Chris Roberts shamelessly ripped off for the Wing Commander series. But they had, like... The Earth forces, so the Kazin are these large man-tigers, okay? Mm-hmm. And they are badasses. They fucking can kill humans easily. But the humans have developed these things called, these soldiers called berserkers or something like that, where they can briefly channel all of their body's strength and adrenaline into, like, one massive killing blow, which is so severe that it, like, it just wears their bodies out and they die as soon as, they're like a bee.
Is this a Wing Commander thing?
No, this is a Larry Niven Man-Kazin Wars thing. And this was
is this after the first Ringworld book?
I mean it's all in part of a big universe. Like, this all happens in the same universe. Like, all that stuff.
All right.
But anyway, it reminded me of that because that seems like what's happened here. I did not know this was a thing in Expanse, but, like, I instantly understood what it is. Is she going to survive? Is she going to die? I don't know.
Mildly interesting.
Did you know about this super serum thing?
I know all about the storyline. I can't say much.
Oh, okay. So is this... Let me ask... Okay, you can't say anything about
it. I mean, I...
Because I wonder, like, is this, like...
It's not a spoiler to tell you how the mechanism works.
Okay, yes, thank you.
Right? Like...
I don't think so.
It's not like a tooth that she bites down on. It's described in the books as her swirling her tongue on the roof of her mouth a couple times.
Oh, no.
And then, like, a clockwise...
Putting, like, a swipe pattern for yourself.
Yeah.
Like, okay.
Essentially, yeah. And then it floods her, you know, nervous system, her adrenaline.
With juice.
Her body with adrenaline, and she, goes berserk.
Goes super strong.
Passes out, as we saw.
Right. So it's, like, not something you can sustain for, like, very long at all.
Oh, no.
Wow. But she does. She just beats this guy down. It's pretty brutal.
It looks at once, like... ridiculous and silly, but it also looks awesome because it looks like no one could ever actually pick this guy up the way she's picking him up, like arms outstretched. I mean, it would break her back to try and do this, but also it makes it look really, really badass.
Well, I think but it's also interesting because you hear all the time about, like, moms lifting cars off their kids and you also, like, I've read a lot that, like, we have a lot more spare muscle power that the body subconsciously governs because we're capable of ripping tendons off our bones in a maximum effort lift.
Right.
But our bodies keep us from doing that. But if you could unlock, like, that spare capacity and flood your body with adrenaline, that you could do, like, some crazy, incredible feats of strength. So I kind of, like, took it like that.
It's more like the mechanics of it. Like, when she picks him up,
she couldn't
actually get the leverage to do it from that direction.
Right.
And I
noticed when she lifts him by his belt, like, he should kind of, like... If she's really yanking him like that, he should, like, bend in half, but he's stiff as a board.
Because he's got a couple of wires attached to him. Yeah. Which... makes it look ridiculous, but also badass.
It is kind of badass. I thought they did really good zero-G work this episode, like, from Naomi floating through the corridors and then attaching her magnetic boots to, and, like, they're getting better and better as they go along with this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, she's dead. He's dead, I think, and she's unconscious. I'm wondering when the bomb will go off. We then see Holden is interviewed by the reporter, and she tries one more time to get him all spun up. She says, "I think you're all liars. No one is honest about why you're here, who you are, what you want." And Holden kind of briefly considers and says, "I'm going to go take a shower and go to sleep."
Yeah.
The camera guy hangs back and says he's going to check the probe because they're in limited supply, especially since Amos is breaking them. And then he does some shady shit with the ship's computers, specifically the maintenance system. What the fuck? Is he a Black Skies saboteur? Here's the thing, is like, since all the factions are working together, I'm not sure who would be, like, who would be trying to sabotage things here.
I don't know.
Because, the Belt is getting what they want, and equals sit at the adult table. The Earth and Mars have just averted, a catastrophic war. Like, what is the faction that wants to fuck all this up at this point?
It's a good question.
And I don't know who Malba, is Malba a Belter? Is she from Earth? Is she, I don't know any of those questions. I guess if I knew her affiliation, I might be able to piece together what's going on here, but... at this moment, the slingshot racer enters restricted space around a ring installation and is confronted by our old friend at the MCRN, Hammurabi. He verbally buys some time. He Han Solos a bunch of technical excuses for why he can't slow down or veer off course until it's too late for them to stop him. He announces he's about to make history.
Oh my God.
I mean, I don't even know how to describe this. As he breaks the plane of the ring surface... instantly, this opaque kind of Stargate-looking liquid appears out of nowhere and instantly slows him down and just pulps his body.
Yeah. It's horrific.
His hands and his face just detach in long, meaty popsicles and, has catastrophic effects on his biological integrity. What the fuck is going on?
And then notably, it doesn't, move after that. It's almost like
it's going
statuesque.
Through super slow mode. And the only thing that bothered me is I feel like if the whole ship decelerated like this, it would fuck up the ship structure. But I also don't know what kind of semi-technological magic it's working with.
Right.
Some kind of structural integrity field that it's extending for a ship. I don't know. But that's the one thing that bothered me is I would think that things would rip off the bulkhead. The ship would the metal would crumple. But the only thing that happens is this soft, squishy being gets squished softly.
I'm looking forward to the reveal of more of that.
But then, at the same time, back on board the Rocinante, Holden is cleaning up after his shower and preparing for bed when he hears some whispering behind him. He turns around, and it's fucking Miller.
Yes.
Sitting in his bed, muttering about time, the laws on Ceres, and good cops, and Holden blinks, and he's gone.
I was wondering if they were going to do this.
Well, fuck you, man. What are they doing?
They're bringing Miller back.
The ghost of Miller?
Is back. That's all I know. But
somehow it's connected to the opening of this weird portal, too. I mean, it has to be.
Mildly interesting.
Unless it's just a coincidence that it snaps into being at the same time that... and I'm going to guess that Miller disappears at the exact same time that subspace phenomenon disappears from the ring. Or maybe it's going to be permanent. I don't know. I haven't seen next week on, so...
I'm excited to have my favorite character back on the show.
Yeah. Oh, well, I'm less excited. He's not my favorite character, but he's fine. I like Thomas Jane. He won me over in season two.
I got to see his hair before I know how excited I am. if it's as greasy and unkempt as humanly possible, I will be happy.
Okay.
The greasier, the better.
You don't want
him to
take a shower. You don't want him to take a space shower.
No, I want him to be dirty Miller.
The proto molecule, apparently that hairstyle works for it because it hasn't changed that much.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, obviously I think this is connected to the ring and what's going on there. I don't think Holden is losing his mind, although I guess that's a possibility. I think there is some kind of space sci-fi fuckery about. And that's the episode. And that's all I got to say about it. Do you know what the Belters, hold dearest of all?
Their pants.
I thought you were going to get it there for a minute.
No,
their independence.
Oh, They're into pants.
They're into pan dance. They're independence. And Bald Move, like the Belters, values our independence. The reason we're able to, you know, be independent and do shows like podcasts on some of these smaller shows we're passionate about, like The Expanse, is because we're entirely listener supported by our club. If you like what we do, you don't have to pay for it. You can enjoy all the stuff that we do for free. But we have some bonus stuff for people that want to go to Extra Mile as a reward. We have weekly shows like Lunch with Jim and Aaron. We have video game playthroughs. We have ad-free versions for podcasts. We have VIP sections of the forums. And for one more week, for all of May, essentially, we're also running a 25% off of our annual memberships, new annual memberships. You can go to club.baldmove.com. There's a ton of material that you can preview for free to see kind of like what is on offer. And if you decide to pull the trigger, again, if you use the code WW2018, you can save 25% off of a new membership at club.baldmove.com. Do we get any feedback from the fans sending to expanse@baldmove.com?
We do have some
any
feedback.
Subspace transmission, any tight beams?
We're going to start off with kind of a meta thing about the books. Raphael G.
Should I plug my ears?
No. Okay. No. He says, now that the show is being canceled, can Jim give some advice on what books to start on if we want to continue reading about it? Do we have to start from the first book, second, etc.?
You're going to do that horseshit thing where everybody's like, you got to start at the beginning.
No.
Okay. Good.
I think the series follows so closely book one that you really don't need to read book one. If you want to know every detail from the books, I would say start at book two because there are some radical departures in season two and the first half of season three.
Are they omissions or additions? Because it seems like
a little of both.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. The additions are Ehrenreich. Ehrenreich has nothing to do with the story in the books, as far as I can tell. He's gone in the first book and just a minor player at that.
Huh.
But yeah, if you really want to get like the whole picture that the books are trying to convey, start at book two. If you like get the gist of the story and just want to start at book three, which is where we just picked up in the show, I would say start there.
So
that's the easiest entry point from here.
So you're going to get probably halfway through the book three by the end of the season? Because that's the thing.
Yeah,
it's like there's not a clean breaking spot where you can be like, well, if you just wait till the end of the season, then go on to book four.
I would assume they're going to like book 3.5 in this season, but maybe they'll blitz through it and get to the end of the third book. I don't know.
It just depends. How much fat is on the bones? Like, are there, like, you know...
Of the books?
Of the
or
books?
The show?
Of the books.
Because
I guess, like, so, like,
it's an
the
interesting
Epstein...
question. I found it all very interesting.
Well, but that, I mean, there's, like, the history of the Epstein Drive is interesting, but it really had nothing to do with the show, or I even imagine the books. It's something... Is that something that they also pulled in from a short story?
Yeah. No, they describe it in the novels.
Oh, okay. Because I'm like, stuff like that, I could see if there's like every three chapters, there's just like, you know, a non sequitur world building moment that the show could probably shortcut.
No, one of the things they do is they kind of, each chapter is named for the character that is the main focus of that chapter.
Yeah.
Which I kind of like.
That's straight out the Game
of
Thrones
playbook. Yeah. So I would say, yeah, if you just really want to pick up where the show is leaving off, start at book three.
Yeah.
And maybe even by the end of the season, start at book four. I don't know.
Yeah. I'm debating whether I want to read the first two books in the off season. I do not want to get ahead of the show because I do like the format where we can have like one person that is reading the books and one person that's not. But I don't know.
I don't think you'll get much out of book one. I think book two, you will get more out of.
But will it potentially spoil? Because like I'm wondering if I'll get like some minor spoilers or it's just like a deeper appreciation.
I think it's just a deeper appreciation.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I might do that because I own the first three books on Kindle. I just didn't get around to reading them. So
yeah.
All right.
All right. Fern says, when the proto molecule hits the Agatha King, Naomi establishes that the prime minister, the PM, works fast. Protomolecule.
Yes.
The prime minister works fast and is spread all over the ship.
The Canadian prime minister is leading a coup against the UN. He works awfully fast.
He does. However, so the protomolecule works fast, has spread all over the Agatha King.
Uh-huh.
However, in the first episode of this season, you see Holden tell everyone to clean the protomolecule off the Rossi that a small amount is lurking on the ship.
I was going to get to that this episode because I meant to talk about that last episode and I skipped over my notes. Like, that
is
Chekhov's protomolecule.
But this is a perfect time to talk about it because he's right. Like, why isn't this thing spreading on the Rossi?
I don't know. It's got radiation. Like, the ship's core gives it enough radiation to, like, that it would want to spread. I don't know. I can't explain it why it's dormant either.
Yeah, it's really sort of boggling my mind that they haven't brought that back up yet.
Did that happen in the books? Is there a piece of the protomolecule on the book? Okay.
Not as I recall.
Man, that's bizarre.
Right?
Because, yeah, it's been a long fucking time. And now, like, I almost forgot that. I'm glad he brought it up because I almost forgot to mention again. 187 plus days have elapsed. Yeah. Yeah, what the hell?
I don't know. We'll see if they ever bring it back up. Maybe it's a thread they accidentally dropped.
I hope not. That'd be
very disappointing.
It
seems too big of a thread.
Yeah, like, why would you show, like, because I remember thinking in the first episode is, like, you know, like, roll my eyes a bit that they'd be able to, like, clean it all off and then being kind of, like, quietly triumphant that it turns out, aha, they didn't. But now we're getting, like, far enough in the season, I'm wondering, well, what's the significance here?
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe that's why Miller showed up. Because you got a personal protomolecule transceiver going on there.
Could be. All right, Stephen from Florida says, on other shows, you often go into detail about the writers, directors, showrunners, and producers. I've noticed you don't do that as much on this show. In light of recent events, I think it might be even more valuable to shout them out since they've been doing such a good job. So if you look into into who's making these shows and how they're doing, I'm sure others would appreciate it. I think that's probably worth doing. Normally, you're the person who, like, has director and writer and those kinds of things.
I am doing that, but, like, I guess the last few or, like, I don't know, the last couple weeks, I think a person on the forum has beaten me to it.
So it's on our forums.
Yeah.
We just don't shout it out in the podcast as much.
And I usually, like, only shout that stuff out when I like if an Alex Graves shows up or, like, a Michelle McLaren or someone that I, like, recognize from another show. Because, like, the thing is, I started doing that during Walking Dead because I had a suspicion, like, that one of the problems in The Walking Dead is that they're cheaping out on the writers and directors. And I feel like I proved that to myself, and then I kind of lost interest in doing it. Because, like, it's also, I'm just really bad with names. So, like, I have to see a director or especially writer's name a dozen times before I start making the connection of, oh, these guys do things that I really enjoy, you know?
Well, I'll shout them out this week. And maybe we'll continue to do this. I don't know. Cause that might actually get the names of people in everyone's head and they can recognize these artists. So it's directed by Kenneth Fink this week. And this is all according to IMDb. So take it with a grain of salt.
Uh-huh.
The writing credits are obviously Ty Frank and Daniel Abraham, who are the creators of the novels and the series.
Which, that's the other thing. It's like, I felt like that was a running theme, that it was always those guys, and then...
And then there's a staff writer, Hallie Lambert.
Right.
So,
who's written a lot of them, I guess.
Okay.
Because, like, I know that I recognize that name from the first episode. But, yeah. I don't know. Go ahead and read, I guess, the next one, because I want to look and see if I recognize any directors just off the top of my head.
Okay. This is the final email. It's from Mike in Louisville. After hearing the fantastic country song about Mars on your last podcast, I began to think about all the place names on Mars and then got curious about how they're named. In researching, I found this article, A Popular Science, which reads in part, "Once scientists obtain the first detailed images of an area on another world, they settle on some themes for the region. These can be official and unofficial. Only features above a certain size get an official designation. For Viking, smaller objects of interest were nicknamed after children's book characters, including Mr. Badger, Mr. Toad, and others from The Wind and the Willows. For Pathfinder, rocks were named for cartoon characters like Bullwinkle, Garfield, Snoopy, and others. and so on for later missions.
Did they name anything after Berenstain Bears, or were they the Berenstain Bears? And which timeline which are we spelling? In?
That's a fair question.
I need NASA to confirm this for me.
They talk about large craters being named for deceased scientists who contributed to the study of Mars, or writers and others who contribute to Mars lore, hence the name Bradbury Landing for Ray Bradbury. Small craters are named for towns and cities with less than 100,000 residents. It seems like they have a lot of different themes going on here.
Wow.
And they're not really connected at all. Big valleys are named for Mars or the word star in different languages, while small valleys are named for rivers on Earth.
Is this real life or is this the show? Okay.
No, this is real life.
Imagine that now that we've been cruising around Mars for over a decade, we probably got a lot of that shit, and we've mapped out every surface detail. Like, we've got all that shit named.
Yeah, that leads right into his follow-up. When Earth was explored and settled, the explorers were often seeing a place for the first time, thus they got the naming rights, so to speak. In the Expanse universe, all of the initial exploration was done remotely, first by telescopes, later by machines sent from Earth. So how pissed would you be if you were the first human to set foot in a place on another planet, but the name was already provided by some idealistic nerd scientist generations ago on Earth? Seems a bit unfair, and I wonder if Martians would make a habit of renaming places when they physically visited them for the first time.
I bet.
Yeah,
they
should be able to.
Yeah. I mean, on the other hand, it's kind of interesting how many of, like, even though we completely colonized and subjugated this continent and essentially committed genocide against all the original inhabitants, it's amazing how much the names of these things are their names.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, our state names, our river names, mountain names, like this stuff is all a lot of First Nations and Native American stuff, and much, and even we're like reversing that trend. Like, stop calling Mount Denali or Mount McKinley, Mount Denali, or going back to calling it Denali. So I could see that there'd be like a wave of like Martians, like, you know, fuck the Earther names. We're going to name it after our people. And then a few hundred years, you know, starting to feel bad about the, you know, that and restoring it. Who knows? It's an interesting cultural question, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think they're feeling bad about it yet.
No, like, I mean, like,
they
like,
will
like,
maybe in the future, but
look, you know, fucking France gives us a little bit of guff for the Gulf War, and we start calling French fries freedom fries.
Right.
You're going to tell me that the Martians aren't going to like spitefully rename a couple of things just, you know, because they're pissed and feeling shitty about the political situation. Yeah, I agree. Mm-hmm. I agree. But it does seem like there is a lot of names that they've retained. Like, what was the one? Where's Alex from? The Mariner Valley?
Mariner Valley, yeah.
That's like a classic name. Surely they wouldn't name Olympus Mons, you know?
Yeah, I wouldn't think so.
But I don't know, maybe the little stuff. They get to name their streets, right?
Oh, yeah.
I wonder,
anything they build, they can name.
I wonder if it's like Atlanta, where like everything's dust this, dust that. Like, you know, in Atlanta, everything's Peach Boulevard, Peach Tree Street,
right.
Peach Avenue. Like, it's dusty lane, dusty street, dusty avenue, dusty boulevard, dusty parkway.
Yep.
Dusty drive. I don't know. What else would you call it?
I don't know. But that's it. That's all I got.
All right. Thanks for all that feedback. We appreciate the support. And you can send us more to expanse@baldmove.com. Or don't forget, on our forums, each week we have a thread for the show at forums.baldmove.com. Can't wait for next episode called It Reaches Out. Ooh, that's an exciting title. We'll see what happens then. Until then, I'm Aaron.
I'm Jim.
Later.